Can letters painting exemplifies a practice that had grown in popularity over the previous centuries in Italy and elsewhere in Europe, and which is the topic of my paper, the staging of temporary painting displays. Temporary displays or exhibitions, and I'm using these two words as synonyms here with the assumption that the phenomenon I'm interested in is not necessarily the same as temporary exhibitions today, they've received little scholarly attention, fleeting and elusive as they were. Art historians, especially preferring to focus instead on the more structural, more permanent structures of the paintings themselves, their production and patronage. While research on Italian art has recently been shifting towards the ephemeral practice of collecting, thereby building on the work of social historian of art Francis Haskell, who pioneered in this field and was indeed the first to study the art exhibition in a historical perspective, exhibitions remain a niche topic, and their transitory character has never been engaged directly. The temporary nature of exhibitions connects its practice with other transitory aspects of paintings and their presentation in this period. By this, I refer to the fact that in early modern Italy, paintings were no static and immutable entities. Instead, they were part of ephemeral ensembles, changing owners, mode of presentation, and even physical appearance over time. They moved from one collection to another. As owners died, collections were dispersed, and new ones built up. The ways paintings were displayed was equally variable, as ideas about presentation developed and objects moved around the house. They were retouched, restored, cut down, enlarged, and in this way often fundamentally changed in appearance. My wider project is concerned with these transitory aspects of early modern painting in order to eventually shift the focus from the static structures of the works themselves to the practices that animated these artworks by foregrounding their appearances as they changed from day to day. And approaching temporary displays of paintings as I propose to do in this paper, focusing on their ephemeral character, I'm interested in a constant oscillation between transitoriness and permanence, between spectacle and substance, between the immaterial and the material that they imply, and that also characterize the large Italian cities of the Baroque more generally. My focus will particularly be on Venice. Venice is a city built in a lagoon, an inherently transitory system, which is bound to eventually fill up with sediment completely, was as ephemeral as a city could ever be. And from the 16th century, which is not unimportantly also the period when a sense of a Venetian artistic heritage arose for the first time, the Venetians began to invest immense effort and money in preserving the precarious balance of their habitat, as they still do today. They even found political meaning in their unique geographic situation. A city in the sea could not ever be conquered or controlled by any foreign power, as the myth of Venice has it. And so in their transitory condition, they discovered sovereignty. I'm interested in this political dimension of the ephemeral, that which exceeds control, that which can hardly be grasped either by historians or by authorities, and thereby offers room to alternatives. There can be no doubt that temporary displays of paintings mark the city's time and space, taking place at a diverse range of moments, but always concurring with important religious or civic events. Exhibitions made manifest the liturgical as well as other calendars, bringing large-scale, colorful objects to already significant locations. These displays filled such places with information and spectacle, and attracted further crowds to what often, even under normal circumstances, were densely populated and visited areas. The question, therefore, needs not so much be whether they produced time and space, but rather whose time and space this was. So I'm posing this socio-political question very consciously here, because one very different way of looking at early modern exhibitions would be to approach them exclusively as precursors to their modern-day counterparts, or formulated differently, as practices having contributed to a modern concept of autonomous art. When clothes merchants exhibited works by Titian, Raphael, and similar very big artists, at the occasion of a military victory in the early 1570s, for example, one might easily see that exhibition as an early instance of an appreciation of art for art's sake. I believe, however, that such a view would be mistaken and only serve to underline a narrative of the Renaissance as the beginning of the era of art, to use Hans Belting's phrase, which is a view that I want to argue against. And I'm therefore particularly grateful of being able to present my project here at this conference on material culture. So first, I want to give you some clues as to the earliest origins and development of painting exhibitions. So Francis Haskell has argued that the first exhibitions of what he calls old master paintings, which is a term that was coined in English in 1777 only, that this took place in 17th century Rome, in connection with saints' feast days and ceremonial entries. Also Florence and across the Alps, for example, Paris, had their annually returning art exhibitions, which were overseen by the respective art academies of these two cities. Yet even earlier than the 17th century, events resembling exhibitions were being held. And I'm referring here to a number of exhibition fairs, so displays of paintings with a partly commercial purpose that were held on or around religious feast days as well. Such was the case, for example, again in Paris with the annual returning fair of Saint-Germain-des-Prés, or on an even larger scale in Antwerp. Just brought this image of the Bourse, which from about 1540 onwards housed a permanent space on the first floor for the sale of pictures. Then in Prague, which is just a fairly random, a different example, Prague, the one-time capital of the Habsburg Empire, a market selling paintings and other artwork was held in a castle, as this print demonstrates, and you see the artwork being prints and paintings being sold over there. So this was held in a castle, and the inscription in the print at the bottom makes clear or makes reference to similar habits even as far back in time as classical antiquity. Now, the earliest occurrence of temporary displays of paintings in Venice was, as far as I can tell, in the context of the city's famous fair of Ascension Day, or as it was called in Venetian dialect, the Fiera della Senza. The Senza seems to have dated from the early 14th century already, and traditionally went on for 2 weeks. It attracted enormous amounts of visitors, some 100,000 in the fair's heydays. On display were all kinds of artifacts Venetian craftsmen produced: paintings, fabrics, lace, jewels, goldsmithery, very importantly in the Venetian context, glasswork. And all of these objects could be admired in what must have been a marvelous and unsurpassed display of art and luxury. Paintings at the Senza seem to have been exhibited in two places, as this undated map in the Venetian state archive suggests. So I've marked them with the red circles. And so this here, from about here to the far end, that's St. Mark's Square. And then the part above is the Piazza di San Marco, so the little square of St. Mark's, and the water, for those of you who are familiar with Venice, the water in front is up there. Now, what this display of paintings at this market could have looked like is suggested by a painting by the 18th century artist Gabriel Bella, which shows these little stalls for the display of objects. And then in the very far background, I'm not sure you can see this, but up there you see the church facade in the middle. And on the facade is at least one big painting being suspended, so for sale, presumably. Now, this artist's work has a tendency to really demonumentalize the appearance of the city. And if you compare his work with Canaletto, for example, you see that Canaletto makes everything look much more monumental and actually a bit more realistic. And he makes Venice look like it's some kind of village, really. So I think in reality, the fair must have been a bit more splendid than this artist makes it look here. So, while the majority of paintings on display at the Senza will have been of contemporary artists, there were also works exhibited by artists already dead. And this, for example, is demonstrated by the artist's biographer Giorgio Vasari, It claims, for example, that a self-portrait by Jacopo Palma, who's a Venetian artist who died in 1528, so that's much before Versailles wrote about this, actually. He claims that that work, which he deems miraculous and extraordinarily beautiful, quote, that it could be seen at the center almost every year. So apparently they repeatedly exhibited this. We're not quite sure that it's actually this painting, but I think there's a good chance. They repeatedly exhibited this work. Now, to describe the censor, Vasari speaks of an exhibition, a mostra, which is the same word that is commonly used in Italian to describe exhibitions nowadays. So what conception did witnesses of painting exhibitions have of such events, essentially originating in religious practices, as illustrated by this 15th century woodcut, which depicts the practice, you could say, in its purest form, namely the act of a priest showing an image of Christ to an audience temporarily. Painting exhibitions in early modern Venice had many similarities to a variety of other cultural practices involving works of art. I'm thinking here of the many processions that involved miraculous images, relics, and liturgical objects, as well as tableaux vivants, which would be carried around by members of guilds and confraternities. This happened many times in the year. Another parallel in Venice can be found in the celebrations around the coronation of the Dogaressa, which was Venice's first lady, so to say. And the celebrations of her coronation included a tour taken by this woman and her entourage through the rooms of the Doge's palace, which were for the occasion lavishly decorated by the various guilds. Now, it is certain that in Venice, temporary displays were always part of something bigger, and an understanding of them as an autonomous phenomenon, despite Vasari's use of an apparently modern-day term, mostra, to describe them, such an autonomous understanding of them did not yet exist. Now, in order to further refine this picture in the rest of this paper, I'd like to look at two exhibitions, or exhibitions between I would like to look at two of them in greater detail. The first of these is a temporary display organized on the occasion of the annual visit of the Doge to the Church of Santa Maria Formosa in the year 1526. Here, this is a picture of the church in its present-day situation. The event is recounted by the Venetian chronicler Marin Sanudo. In an entry to his diaries of the 1st of February of that year, he mentions that the church was decorated by instigation of the new parish priest with works of art from the collection of the late Cardinal Domenico Grimani. And the Grimani family had their palace nearby, so this was their parish church. Sanudo takes note of the many tapestries with which the church had been decorated, and other hangings executed in gold, he mentions. He further singles out a bronze portrait bust, as well as several paintings made in Rome, as he claims, by Michelangelo. Now, while it's not easy to understand what kind of work Sanudo would have had in mind, because we hardly know of any transportable paintings made by Michelangelo in Rome in this period, nevertheless, his record is revealing with regards to the origins of the objects being put on display. So to celebrate this religious feast day, namely the 1st of February, that's the celebration of the purification of the Virgin, one of the wealthiest and most art-loving families in the area gave parts of their collections on loan. It is surely significant also that it was the very same Domenico Grimani whose donation of a collection of antique sculptures to the Republic led to the creation of Venice's first public art museum, the Statuario Pubblico, as early as the 16th century. In any case, the display at Santa Maria Formosa of 1526 illustrates the use of private collections for such events. It also demonstrates the connections between temporary exhibitions and the transitory nature of collecting and presenting within the confinements of the house. The collections of the Grimani clearly moved around. Within their palazzo, as they worked on the construction of a monumental shrine for their art throughout the 16th century. I'm showing you here just one of the rooms of the palace that has a few years ago only been made open to the public again. The objects also moved around within their neighborhood of Paris, as Sanudo's words show, and within the larger city. One wonders then about the possible democratizing impulse behind such movement, or in other words, the aims and effects of their sharing their paintings, sculptures, tapestries, and other treasures with the wider public. A second example takes me to the 18th century and more genuinely into the neighborhoods. A different kind of occasion that prompted the organization of temporary painting displays arose when a parish elected a new parish priest, or pievan, which is, by the way, a word ultimately derived from plebs or the people. Having been elected by the members of his parish and subsequently accepted by the patriarch, the Venetian religious leader, the priest and his cortege would enter the neighborhood and receive canonical possession of the parish and the church. The whole community celebrates on such occasions. The neighborhood would be lavishly decorated. People prepared festive meals. They wrote poetry and published about the occasion. Now, this painting here shows such a ceremonial entry, one taking place at Santa Margherita, the church we see at the far end of the homonymous square. The priest is touring the square, escorted by his new colleagues, Santa Maria's deacons, subdeacons, and other clergymen. The square is filled with a good number of people, men and women, young and old, patricians and commoners alike. The artist has captured a moment when the cortege is admiring the window displays and paintings on the left side of the square. And indeed, the abundance of the decorations put up for the occasion is remarkable. Not only paintings, but also draperies and tapestries give the houses a festive appearance, which is further enhanced by all the onlookers hanging out of the windows. While the subject matter, age, and quality of the paintings that are being displayed on the facades is hard to define, at least one of them at the far left of the composition has an identifiable subject. So that's this painting here. And here we have a detail, so it's the painting you see in the detail on the far left, and I'm not sure you can see this, but this painting depicts a human pyramid, or as it was called in Venice, a Forza d'Ercole, so force, or one of the tasks of Hercules. Now we'll return to this tiny image in a second. First, something else. In the second half of the 18th century, so the period this painting was made, precisely these decorations and celebrations evoked in this painting to celebrate the inauguration of parish priests, they became the object of contestation. While apparently already in the 16th century elections of parish priests occasioned much festivity and pomp, in the second half of the 18th century, so the period from which this painting dates, documents show that the Venetian government had real problems with this tradition. In various decrees, the government forbade decorations, celebrations, receptions and pomp in shops and on squares for the election of parish priests and other local officials altogether. Such ostentation, the decree of 1767 goes on to specify, was, and I quote, not suitable to those who were to occupy the holy office. Despite these interventions from the state, however, the practice continued. Now, it's striking in this regard that precisely a Forza d'Ercole, a human pyramid, has been chosen for the one recognizable painting in the painting. These acrobatic tour de force became popular as a substitute for the equally athletic but much more violent bridge fights that the Venetian reveled in during the 17th century. Here's just one painting representing such a bridge fight. Often resulting in casualties, these fights between the two traditionally opposing factions of the Castellani and Nicolotti were forbidden in 1705. The human pyramids and other exercises that the two factions would also compete in increased in popularity from then on. And here you see such a human pyramid again, and here on the Piazzetta San Marco. Now, the inclusion of a painting representing a human pyramid in the bigger canvas showing the exhibition then posits the material and visual culture of temporary exhibitions, I would argue, as an assertion of the right to factionalism and neighborhood pride. To return to the main topic of this paper, so early modern art exhibitions as movers of objects, one thing I hope to have shown is that these events, including their representations and commemorations in paintings, prints, and other documents, functioned as instruments in the production of group identities. Guilds, families, and parishes used temporary exhibitions to present themselves to their peers, and sometimes in order to assert their autonomy within and vis-à-vis the state. Another case I want to make is for the performative character of the exhibitions. Often part of elaborate and multi-sensory celebrations, displays of paintings could be expected to take place next to and in interaction with other art objects, architecture, music, poetry, and festive meals. In an age in which museums are increasingly bringing elements of performance, dance, poetry, music, and indeed eating into their galleries, examining the origins of this practice within the early modern period seems particularly relevant. What is more, these exhibitions did not only move objects, but they clearly also moved people, and in doing so transformed the spaces of the city. Yet another example of how complete built and lived environments are objects in motion in their own right. Thank you.